Welcome everyone to Rock M Nation Podcast. We are back. It's been a couple weeks. We've got episode, what are we on, four, five now, five? I think this is five, episode five, season five. I'm your host, Sam Snelling. With me as always, Matthew J. Harris. Matt, how are things in Indiana?
Very wet, but unlike St. Louis, we weren't run over by severe weather. So we're just a little soggy, but no worse for the wear here.
The North County region, which is where I'm residing, actually was able to avoid most of the really severe stuff. I think it kind of pushed south and north of us. So
yeah, down near
Farmington, they got brutalized a little bit. So last we spoke, well, that was the Bossy Pod, right?
We got
a lot of recruiting stuff out of the way. We think Missouri is pretty much done with their class as far as the freshmen are concerned. I'm sure if there are any postseason defections, they'll probably readdress, maybe look at some transfers. Mark Mitchell is still out there. I was alerted to a little bit of a rumor that Missouri had maybe gained some ground in Mark Mitchell's recruitment. I would like to dispel those notions right away. Matt, I know that that you and I have long sort of said that it seems likely that Duke and UCLA are the leaders. After I was sort of notified that there was a rumor that Missouri had kind of, you know, taken in second place, I asked around just in case. I don't like to be unprepared. And I was told that is not correct. That is bad info. And Mitchell still looks like it is either UCLA or Duke. Apparently, he was wowed on his trip to Cameron, and is.
I'm stunned that he was. Frankly, I mean that's cool, only kind of
right. And like one of the things is like, okay, so NIL is a big deal right now. Everybody's talking about NIL. So NIL is going to be a big deal for Mark Mitchell and his recruitment. And let's be honest here, like, who do you think is going to put together a better NIL package for Mark Mitchell? Duke, like arguably the greatest basketball program of the last 30 or 40 years here. What, 30 years? 30 years. We'll go 30 years. Arguably the best program of the last 30 years. Or UCLA, arguably the greatest college basketball program of all time. Or Missouri. Which we love Ole Mizzou. We are here for Ole Mizzou. We are podcasting about Ole Mizzou. Not quite in that same stratosphere, Matthew.
No, and UCLA also happened to make, I would say they got actually an upgrade when Under Armour bailed on like a 15-year apparel deal with them. And let UCLA get scooped up by Jordan Brand. So you can go to Hollywood, where you have an older brother who kind of works in the entertainment industry, play for one of the greatest programs of all time on a really great campus, and for a program that's affiliated with arguably one of the biggest sports apparel brands in the world. I mean, and on a roster that, you know, seems like it's going to be set up well for the next couple of years.
And I will say, if you're looking at the comparison, like I do think that any NIL deal, I think, could probably be sweeter at Duke because of your market. And realistically, like the UCLA market, LA is huge.
It's saturated.
It's saturated. It's, you're worried. I mean, the Dodgers, the Lakers, the Clippers, the
two NFL teams. Well, one and a half NFL yeah, the, teams. The,
let's see, Rams, Chargers, Kings. I missed a baseball team. The Angels. And then USC's up there. Too. Yeah, so it's competitive. Duke is a very much a national brand at this point. they are their fan. The fans have spread far and wide, and it's, you know, like, you can call them fair weather or whatever. But you know, there's fans in every city. People have been, you know, fans of Duke since they were kids. You know, so you have that marketability. You know, obviously, Durham, North Carolina is not exactly a huge metropolis, but there are some, you know, good sized cities in Carolina. And so I think either of those places, you're going to get a really sweet a package of name, image and likeness that I just don't think Missouri can compete with. Maybe someday we can hope. We need some big name donors, Matt, to kind of step up and just start throwing money around.
Yeah. Let's
offer Mark Mitchell the Michael Porter Sr. deal and see how that. We just need, like, you know, one of these. Are the Laurie still spending for the program?
Not as much. No. Maybe Don Walsworth. Maybe Mark can become the face of Walsworth Publishing. Maybe. You know, I like this binding. It's the best you're going to find. But no, the Mitchell ship seems to have sailed. We didn't mention the last time, but Robert Jennings last month, another guy that Missouri kind of had in on an official visit, committed to Texas Tech. Not a surprise there. They've basically lapsed recruiting Chandler Jackson, who's the point guard out of Memphis, who looks like he's set to pick sometime soon.
He's down to, I think, Ole Miss is still in it. I think Tennessee,
Florida State, like those are the programs that still seem to be in it. Maybe.
Yeah. Interesting to me that,
or Virginia Tech.
Did he say
Virginia
he was
Tech
down to like Auburn and Missouri or something? And that, like, and now I don't know.
Yeah. Then Kansas got in the mix, and there were some other programs that came in after he jumped up in the composite and he pushed his timeline out, and it seemed like
then his stock went down in the composite, and you know, it thinned out a bench.
He's a top 60. He's still a top 60 prospect at this point, but I think Missouri made its ball handling choice with Christian Jones back in July. So point is, the board is thinned out at this point, and we'll probably go into spring and see who are the three or four guys not in Missouri's rotation that maybe want to reboot somewhere else, and is there an opportunity for Missouri to go and try and maybe upgrade at some positions. As always, we don't like to forecast before games have been played who they are, but I think in this market with the one-time transfer rule, if you're a guy who's a sophomore or older and you're not in that top nine at this point, maybe you start to look somewhere else and use your free move. So that's something to always keep an eye on, is sort of how the rotation shakes out and, you know, how big of a role the guy's had over a couple of years, and will he look to reboot somewhere else? But that would probably be the only way I'd expect Missouri to maybe make a move.
Well, it is interesting because, you know, we did get a little bit of a glimpse, and we'll get into this in a little bit, of what the potential rotation could look like this year. You know, but we are November 9th is a Tuesday. College basketball actually starts with the Saturday before. Or did I just miscount my previews?
I mean, I think as long as you're there by November 9, you're going to get Missouri done. I can't remember when the Champions Classic is. Maybe it's before that a little bit, but it's slow through that first weekend. I don't think they open up on a weekend because they don't want to compete with college football. So maybe Monday might be the Champions Classic, and then you move through on that, move into Tuesday, and things begin to open up a little bit. But yeah, they 2 weeks. Is where we sit before a completely gutted Central Michigan shows up to Mizzou Arena with Tony Barbie, and we usher in the 2021-22 season.
Yeah, so we are in full on like preview mode here, and we're not gonna like talk about Central Michigan or UMKC or anything. At this point, I think there's still kind of time to get there. You know, but it is sort of like season preview. We've had some exhibition action. I know that
they're no longer secret scrimmages.
Well, yeah. So Georgia, who we've all thought is going to be terrible, played a like charity exhibition game and lost to Charlotte by, I think, 8 or 10 points.
Yeah.
And Charlotte is not a good basketball team.
Arkansas struggled with East Central, the mighty D2 power out of the Great American Conference this week.
East Central was 10-9 last year, Matt. So interesting tidbit on that. So yeah, so Arkansas played in a exhibition game. They played their like four of their five starters, I think like 26 or 28 minutes or something like that, to make sure that they secured that win over East Central out of Oklahoma. East Central features two young men on their roster who are Crutchfields. And Crutchfield was the coach last year, who was the former Arkansas assistant under Eric Musselman. And he left to go coach his boys, has since taken a job at Oregon. So he was only there for a year. And who took over was a guy who I think was a GA for Arkansas when Crutch and Muss were both there. And he marched his, what are they, the Lions or something?
The Tigers.
The Tigers. I knew it was a cat. He marched the East Central Tigers into Bud Walton Arena and put a scare into the Hawks. So there was that result, and then
LSU played an exhibition too, I think.
Alabama played
LSU one. Also. LSU and Alabama both played exhibitions. So,
trying to remember the Alabama score, but they won, but it wasn't by a lot.
Yeah, we're in the time of year where everyone's overreacting, and okay, maybe not Georgia, because Georgia's going to be terrible. But
you should overreact to Georgia.
Man, and they don't have PJ Horn, which is almost even worse for them now. So we're in secret closed, not secret scrimmage, depending on how insane some coaches are about whether or not they want to actually divulge results. Missouri at least acknowledges in group photos that yes, we went to Emporia State and we repped game situations with Oklahoma State, and then on Saturday they tweet out a picture of everyone from Creighton with everyone from Missouri and say, great work today, we closed scrimmage Creighton. And those scrimmages are sometimes different. Like sometimes you'll play full 40-minute games, but you may go to six fouls. You may set up certain in-game situations.
You may
to rep out.
You may request that, you know, that they play a zone in certain scenarios. And
yeah, sometimes like if you may just go do basically like the equivalent of like an NFL like shared practice, where you come in and you'll rep your sideline out of bounds situations, your baseline out of bounds situations, your zone offense. You might face junk defenses. You might want to put that you're down five with X amount of time on the clock. Can we execute in this situation? It looks like, based on some evidence that we have, that Missouri went the full 40 with Creighton, but nobody saw the context of what that game looked like. Outside of that, it ended in a 61-61 tie. But that's one of those things too, where people will say, oh, Creighton's like 53rd or something in KenPom and Missouri's, you know, 97th. That's a great result for Missouri. And you're like, well, I guess, but we didn't see how the game transpired and sort of what the game flow looks like in that kind of context. But, it's preseason. People want to find as much information as they can and sort of, you know, reasons for optimism or pessimism at this point.
Yeah, and so we did, I guess, catch a glimpse. Somebody had sent me a what appears to be the box score. And I almost like am hesitant to talk about it because it's really impossible to derive much other than it looks like, I know you'll be, everybody will be shocked by this, but Missouri didn't shoot the ball particularly well. They really outscored Creighton around the basket, which I would think is a good thing. You know, but it's just like I saw this and I'm like, I don't even know if I want to share it. I sent it to you. I'm like,
I ran like our box score thing on it just to like have like a top level sort of look at it. Cause you, and like, even like I'm looking at the numbers right now and like I could loosely summarize kind of everything, but like Missouri shot 15.8% from 3-point range. Now, its leading shooters on the day from long distance were like supposedly Kobe Brown, Dejuan Gordon, and Jerron Coleman. If I were to pick three guys that I would be skeptical of having put up 12 3-point attempts, those guys would be in that group. They went 3 of 12 from 3-point range. The rest of the team went 1 of 6. Yaya Keita went 0 of 3 from 3-point range. So realistically there, you have 3 of 15 from four guys who I wouldn't say are your prime shooters on this roster. So, but how did those shots come about? Were they in transition? Were they off screens? Were they kicked? Were they, like I think you mentioned before, were they guarded, unguarded? Just sort of what was the result of the action there? Like Missouri outscored Creighton supposedly 44-28 in the paint. How were those touches given? You know, what actions did they come off of? You know, Creighton outscored Missouri by 12 from behind the arc, 21-9. But almost 47% of Creighton's shots were 3-point attempts. And they shot 24.1% though. So Creighton just outscored Missouri based on sheer volume from deep. But Missouri offset that by outscoring them in the paint. So like there's all kinds of stuff you can derive from that, but without watching, you know, how those possessions unfolded, it's hard to really say, oh God, I'm like worried about X, Y, and Z of what this team's gonna do. And how that's going to sort of operate from them. All we can really say is when Missouri held onto the ball, they did a pretty good job scoring in the paint. They had their true shooting percentage was dragged down by poor jump shooting and everything else was kind of a push. So it's really hard to,
and it also should be pointed out that this is all assuming that the stats are accurate because you know, like it's possible that they don't have like an official score there. Maybe it's a GA just kind of keeping track. And I mean, there's a lot of assumptions being made here. So it is interesting. It says that, you know, the biggest lead Mizzou had at one point, a 13-point lead, the best scoring run. Both teams went on 8-0 runs at some point. Six lead changes, 5 times tied. Mizzou spent 27 minutes of clock time in the lead. Creighton spent 8 minutes and 36 seconds. To me, this sounds a lot like, you know,
the Oregon game last
year.
Yeah,
like it's,
which was also coincidentally enough in Omaha. No, it's, to me, the real value here is probably the film that the coaches bring back.
Yeah, like, exactly.
Like, this is what we did well. This was, you know, situations where we could have played better. You know, like it's the film, and like having the stats helps because you have like a loose guide for how guys performed, but the film is what matters here. And, you know, if we see the box score, like cool, but the value here is the film. And no one, at least that I know of in the Missouri program, is like sending me Dropbox folders with, you know, some poor GA trying to track the action from left to right and letting us watch stuff. So, and it's not stuff that's even getting like tagged and uploaded into Synergy, which if you're even doing that, like you're at least trying to be somewhat accurate and you're tagging us stuff. So
I would be, very open. If anybody listening actually has the game film, and they want to send it to us, I would be open to watching it.
I would love to watch it. I'd get a kick out of it. Cause to me, like the biggest value of this piece of paper is like, I told you this, and I sent you a screen grab of it, is like the minutes played is the number of minutes guys played, their usage on offense, like their plus minus and their points per possession. Like, what was the rotation? What were guys' usage when they were on the floor? And just kind of broadly, how efficient were they? Like, that's really all I draw from it. Like, so we can get into that a little bit. I mean, I've run those numbers, but that's all I really care about. And we can talk about kind of just how the rotation sets up. But like the nitty gritty numbers of true shooting and 3-point shoot, all that stuff is almost secondary to the high level of how much did guys play, how much of the offense was routed through them, and how efficient were they with their touches. Like, that's as much as I wanted to glean from the box score as anything.
I think I was probably the most interested in who was playing the most. And I know that, like, one of the things I think we've learned about, you know, Konzo at this point is he's open to playing a large number of guys and sort of riding with somebody who may be playing better and giving them more time. It kind of seems like the guy that was the beneficiary of that was Javon Pickett. Pickett played the most minutes of anybody. And honestly, like, you know, I'm not saying that that's going to be like, he's going to be the stalwart, but you know, when it comes to this sort of situation, and even, you know, Martin talked about it in his presser today, he talked about how of all the guys on the roster, Javon is the guy who is sort of most ready to go. Cause like he's been through these battles before. He knows what to expect. He knows how to get himself ready. And there's, you know, like a whole group of freshmen who have never done it at the collegiate level. There's all these transfers who have done it at the college level, but, you know, they're stepping into a high major level. So really you're kind of looking at, Kobe Brown, you're looking at Javon Pickett and Deshaun Gordon as the three guys who have prepared to play at this level before. And everybody else is still kind of learning how to do that. So it did.
And you can see why Pickett played a lot. Like, he played according to this stat sheet, he played 30 minutes, scored 12 points, yanked down 8 rebounds, and dished out 6 assists. But what's really impressive about that is he scored 12 points on 14% usage and only had 8 possessions. And so 1.5 points per possession. So when the ball was coming to Pickett, it was in advantageous scoring positions and he converted, but he was doing other stuff, getting on the glass, especially defensively. I think he had like all of his rebounds were defensive rebounds. So he's hitting the defensive glass. He's got 6 assists. So he's moving the ball. And when he's getting his offensive touches, they're in advantageous situations that he can execute. That's a guy that if you're going to get 12, 8, and 6 out of him off 14% usage, and he's, you know, rebounding at your guard spot, which this team needs because it maybe doesn't have as much traditional size. Yeah, you're going to roll with that guy for 30 minutes. So that's
other than our man Jordan Wilmore.
Hey, Jordan got 12 minutes. Granted, 4 of them were after he picked up that 5th foul. But then, like, to contrast that, like, again, we're not going to read too much, but like Kobe Brown played supposedly 25 minutes. I want to double check this, but 34.5% usage and 0.78 points per possession. Like, Kobe Brown needed, I think, 12 shots to score 13 points and only grabbed 2 rebounds, dished out 1 assist, went 1-of-5 from 3, and had 3 turnovers. So, like, if you look at the raw minutes there, like, again, it would help having film, but if you looked over the box score and looked at that usage, you would say, okay, Kobe got to 13, but his plus minus was 8. So was Kobe on the floor, you know, giving you...
His plus minus was -8.
It was -8. So...
Meanwhile, our guy, Ronnie DeGray, had a plus 12.
Yeah, but Ronnie DeGray, again, like, 6 points on 5 field goal percentages, but the guy got on the glass, you know. DeGray got his 12 points on 16% usage. Like, so it seems like what we're drawing out here is
Javon.
He's bigger Javon.
And it's like, that's what I've been calling him since they got him. Like, he's bigger Javon Pickett.
Yeah. But then you like see a guy like Amari Davis played 20 minutes, 10% usage, -4 in the plus minus. really only got four possessions, scored 4 points. Like, just, you know, ball didn't really come his way a lot. But, like, you look at the numbers and stuff here, like, the guys who played the most minutes were Pickett, Kobe Brown, Jerron Coleman, and Dejuan Gordon. The plus minus for Pickett was 4, plus minus for Kobe Brown, -8, Jerron Coleman, -3, Dejuan Gordon, 3. So what you really do is you go look at, you know, your two guys here. Coleman, who we thought was maybe going to be a ball handler for this team, didn't have a real efficient day. Kobe Brown didn't have a real efficient day. But those were sort of the four guys that Zoe rolled with, and his fifth and sixth guys were Davis and DeGray. Like, there was not a freshman in the top six.
Yeah, Brookshire played about, you know, 16 minutes. Yaya
played
17. And it kind of looks like those are going to be the guys that are going to be in the rotation with Dura Gordon, Caleb.
And Caleb at the back.
And
at least.
And Brazil didn't play.
But he did play in the Oklahoma State scrimmage.
Yeah, he did, and he was there. And we've talked about in the past about the possibility of him being a redshirt guy. If you've been listening to the pod, I don't know, since Brazil committed way back last year in September, I mean, you know that, like, this is a bit of a unique situation. He's a kid who sprouted up late, and his body is still developing. But he's got, like, all the potential in the world to be, and I don't hesitate to sort of say it, but I think he's got the potential to be an NBA player. You know, because I don't want to say, like, I mean, he's not a guy who I think is going to be an NBA All-Star, but I mean, you look at his size, his ranginess, the fact that he has a workable jump shot, and I think you can turn him into a 3-and-D guy who can play, you know, 5 to 10 years in the league if he develops. But it is entirely possible that they give him a year of not worrying about competition. This isn't a year that I think, you know, Martin is super worried about, you know, winning the SEC or anything like that. And so if you give that guy a year to develop and you bring him next year with him and Aiden Shaw, you know, that could be a monstrous defensive team next year. And and especially if you're giving some other guys opportunities to really kind of develop. And the thing that I'm kind of curious is what you would see from Dura Gordon, what you would see from, you know, Caleb Brown. I am a little surprised that it looks like Wilmore is going to be as much of a part of the rotation, because from what we saw from the last year, I didn't think Wilmore.
But he's down 70 pounds, so.
Right, yeah. So I'm like, he's a guy, like, I've gone from, like, kind of thinking, all right, this is a guy who's probably going to transfer at the end of the year, to a guy, but, like, I kind of want to see him play. I want to see the difference in how he's going to move when he's supposedly put the effort into the weight room.
Well, we can segue into what Martin was saying today about the rotation, but nothing that when I look at the minutes here really surprises me. If you look at the top five in minutes, it's Pickett, Kobe Brown, Jerron Coleman, Dejuan Gordon, Mari Davis. Bunch of vets. Not surprised about that at all. And then, you know, to me the question was, where was DeGray going to work in here? But I thought Kaden and Brookshire were going to be two freshmen that worked in. So if it's DeGray right now and you're going to let Brazil sort of, you know, develop for a year, I guess, and then you'll use Wilmore as sort of that spot big, you're at 8-9 right there, pretty much. So it really is going to be nothing when I look at kind of the overall usage here and, you know, minutes played jumps out at me. I think what's going to be more interesting and what's going to be really worthwhile in the first 3 to 4 games is to really watch how Martin mixes and matches his combinations. I track all the rotations and the lineups, but I think that's going to be really, really interesting and why I've sort of held off really sort of trying to project anything or write very much, because I want to watch this roster play 3 or 4 games and then go, okay, this is sort of, these are the rotations that Martin's trying, and here's the ideas behind them, and here's what they're trying to do with those rotations. But if you were to look at just a raw pecking order, none of what, you know, you sort of see again from off this one piece of paper really surprises me all that much as to how it breaks down.
So I attended the press conference today, and you know, there was a lot of discussion over, and so the press conference today was, it was not in person, it was over Zoom. It allows my work from home ass to be able to you know, carve out 20 minutes of my schedule and pull up a Zoom link. But there was a lot of discussion over, you know, rotations and sort of the, you know, the way, because, you know, one of the things that I think has sort of been a theme early on the season of Martin and his press conferences is he keeps kind of referring to Kobe Brown as like a point guard. And so I was like, I was intrigued by him using that term. I know like a lot of us sort of overstate the terminology of saying, you know, point guard or
point forward.
Yeah, like all this different stuff and like what it means as we move into the quote unquote positionless style of basketball. You know, but if Kobe Brown is initiating offense with a you know, like a 6'9" guy on him, then like I don't have a problem with that. If he's trying to bring the ball up against like a 6'2", you know, guard, that's probably not the best matchup. You know, and so I think Missouri is probably going to be taking an approach of you know, point guard by committee this year. They're not really going to have one guy who's going to handle the ball. They're going to have a, you know, whoever has the best matchup. And if you're getting out and you're attacking early in the clock, then it's, you're going to have probably 3, 4, 5 guys on the floor at any given time who can take the ball and go.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you were to look at what Brown's most efficient touches are, it's still him cutting and it's still him getting on the glass. I think but the hard part here is, you know, I think over the last 2 years, we've seen kind of, if you even look at things that like sort of measure XG or expected shot outcomes and like how that impacts like spacing on the floor. Like I'm looking at one right now from Shot Quality. Kobe Brown's in the 21st percentile nationally. That's not good. So like if you have Kobe, who's not really affecting the game as a floor spacer, but he's, you know, in the 75th percentile in terms of offensive rebounding and putbacks, and he's really sort of middling at rim efficiency at 46%. Are there ways you can sort of isolate him like we're talking about in matchups that are favorable where he can take a 6'9 big and drive? And when he's at the rim, it's not being met by a longer defender. It's being met by a guard rotating. Is that a matchup that's sort of advantageous there? So like if you're going to, you know, run, do you have him initiating in a pick and roll and getting a switch out and sort of stuff like that, or a pitch back and driving against a big? That might be it. But if you're talking about, is he coming up and initiating a high ball screen with, you know, Kata or Wilmore or DeGray, I'm not sure what that kind of offense looks like. So again, I'm sort of like,
we want to watch him.
I read, yeah. And so I think, you know, when Konzo talks about, you know, we have 4 guys handling, is it situational based on lineups? Like, you know, last year it was clear you wanted Drew and Xavier Benson to handle, and a lot of their actions, Missouri would change some of the action they ran based on who was on the floor and operating as the main ball handler, but you knew who the 2 guys were who were going to initiate. I'm sort of curious this year, like if Amari Davis gets it, Amari Davis playing out of ball screens, ball handlers I wrote about, is great when he gets it kind of coming off a rocket ball screen and gets to turn the corner, you know, into the slot, and he can pull up or he can hit sort of a guy in the short corner if his defender steps up. Is that the sort of action where Amari Davis is acting as a handler versus Jerron Coleman, who can probably play more in straight high pick and rolls or spread pick and rolls? Like, so that's sort of what I'm interested in. I think a lot of people are saying, you know, might react, oh God, they have 4 point guards. To me, the question is, do they have, what's the lineup, and then what sort of actions are we going to see initiated there? And that's obvious, but again, that's why we got to see this team play and sort of watch how things filter out.
And it's also like, you know, what actually led me to kind of, you know, chime in and ask him the question. So the question that I asked him is, you know, like, I feel like the coaching staff has done a pretty good job of adjusting their offensive approaches based on what talent they have available. You know, they brought in Cornell Mann, who could help sort of implement this, you know, Iowa State offense when Michael Porter Jr. was coming in, you know, like more of a guy at the combo forward spot who can really, you know, play through that guy a lot. Into Jonte when, you know, Jonte was going to be initiating some offense through his, you know, if you want to call that, you know, the combo forward spot. And then kind of sticking with that offense, finding it wasn't working, and then moving into, like a ball screen offense. Because the offense itself, without Jonte and then that first part was well run, and it generated the kind of shots it was supposed to generate. The problem is Missouri didn't have the talent capable of making the available shots. And so they pivoted. They went to the Barcelona ball screen, you know, continuity kind of offense. And so I was just sort of curious if they were going to adapt that, because they don't have, Drew Smith and Xavier Pinson on the roster anymore. The reason that it made sense going to that is because you had two guys who were really good at running off ball screens, with some, debate warranted on how good Xavier Pinson actually was with it. But you had, two guards who could really handle the ball and in general make good decisions on ball screens. And you had a post who was exceptional at setting a screen and diving at the rim.
Roll. Yeah.
So it made a lot of sense. And now you don't have that roster. And so like, this is one of the reasons why I'm just so fascinated by what they're going to do with this roster is how do all those offensive approaches and how do the, how do they apply the personnel within a style that was really kind of meant for one thing and now it's going to do something else. So, I thought it was interesting because he basically said that they were going to stick with Barcelona. Like they like what they get out of it. They like that, they can put the ball in different guys' hands I think he thinks that they've got, the guys around them that can make the kind of shots. So we'll see.
I think that's, and you and I have talked about the last 2 days, I'm more skeptical on the floor spacers that they have for this offense. If you're going to talk about Kobe Brown being a guy who needs to take a step forward, the jump shooting has to get there. But Kobe's, no matter how you look at it, whether it's traditional stats, analytic stats, you break down shot charts, you look on film, largely the same kind of floor spacer he was as a freshman during his sophomore season. It doesn't always hold, but by and large, the biggest gains in shooting we see come during a sophomore year. There's actually a slight regression as a junior because usually defenses account for you more, so you have more contested jumpers, and then you kind of settle out. Guys who've typically like never seen that jump are what they are as shooters. So if you're saying, okay, we need Kobe to get from 25% to 32%, again, outliers exist. I'm not, speaking ill of Kobe or the work that he puts in the gym. I'm just saying the body of evidence tells us that's a big jump for a guy to make. Same with Dejuan Gordon, a guy who was a 31-32% shooter as a freshman, regressed, that happens. But usually bounce back years only bounce back to what they were prior. So you're bouncing back to a 31% jump shooter from three. So you've got a 25% shooter, a 31% shooter. Amari Davis is a guy who's got to show that his volume and his accuracy can get better. And Jerron Coleman shot the ball better at the end of last year. But from everyone I talked to and from the film I watched and from the numbers I looked at, the question for him is, were the final 7 or 8 games for Ball State a breakthrough, or did he just get on a heater and he's really closer to a 29 or 30% shooter? Because now you've got 4 guys in this offense who are going to probably play major roles, and the best one's probably a 31% three-point shooter. The spacing is going to get hard in this offense, and you talk about the pick-and-roll situation. Jeremiah Tillman was probably, Now, Colin Castleton and him were basically a runoff for all SEC at center last year. And, you know, now you have a freshman in Yaya Katie, you got Willmore, you maybe have Brazil in that role. You're going to see a step back there, and you don't even have a, like, if things got really tough, you could just dump the ball in on an early entry post up to Tilly and he could go to work. Do you even have that as a safety valve? So I think that's what I'm interested in, is just, you know, for this to work, the floor spacing has to be there. So ball handling is one issue, and they can kind of, as we mentioned earlier, they can kind of tweak who's handling based on lineup and set. But overall, the shooting across the lineup has to get better, because last year Missouri was not a good shooting team from deep. And in terms of floor spacing, that creates issues. So again, that's sort of the other thing I'm looking at as we move forward here, is does the offense works best when you've got lanes open and you can't stunt and you've got some operating room in the middle of the floor? That's harder if this team can't shoot.
So we've definitely got a little bit to go on at this point, but not a lot. With, I think basically our plan will be record again next week. Do a little bit more of a preview. Maybe we'll have a guest on. Who knows? Never know what's going to happen, Matt. You never know. But I think as we move into the season, it's just going to be really interesting to see how everything sort of plays out. Missouri has not gifted themselves a very easy setup. We've talked about it before. The non-conference schedule is
not easy.
It's not easy. In order for them to, set themselves up for, a potential NCAA tournament look, they can't lose any of the toss-up games. I mean, they have to beat Utah. They have to beat Wichita State. They have to beat Liberty. I think you can lose to Illinois and you can lose to KU. And
you got
to
probably beat SMU.
I think you have to probably, you have to win at least one game in Jacksonville. This team is just, it's so interesting. And, you know, maybe I'm finding way more interest in it because we've been watching, so much of the same thing over the last 2-3 years that it's nice to have something that is new. And this team is very new.
It is. I think, there's always going to, and we talk about it seemingly every pod, there's going to be a contingent that's not going to be happy with the outcomes this year. I think I had, before they added Paul Quinn to the schedule, I had Missouri at 14-16 overall, 7-11. Adding Paul Quinn, college and NIA opponent, probably gets them to 15-16, but for all intents and purposes, that does not matter. But it's what this team looks like in putting that together. You know, are they barely eking out wins over, teams like Central Michigan, UMKC, Northern Illinois? Are they scratching and clawing their way to 14 wins? Or are they playing really well against teams they should beat, flipping a few results, and then just, they need seasoning if they're going to, pick up 4 or 5 more quality wins, against those teams in the middle of the SEC that are going to allow them to contend? It's going to be what this team looks like. And I think, we talk about Zoe's future and he's safe this year. Every bit of reporting seems to indicate that. But this is a year that I think really goes a long way in determining what the thermostat is going into year 6 and what sort of perceptions are here. If this team, you and I have, you wrote in the preview that, Konzo Martin tends to set a baseline, and when his teams don't have bad injury luck, it's probably 7 wins. If this team, goes 6-6 in the non-con and goes 7-6 in non-con and 5-13 in SEC play, I think next year's going to be sort of interesting. But everyone right now sort of looking ahead and sort of prejudging what the, prejudging and the impact of this season, I think you're carrying your own biases into it. So I'm just excited to see what, Zoe's excited about, what this roster is, so we can have some objective sort of, you know, data to look at and evaluate. But the non-con schedule after the first three games is there's not many points of forgiving outside of Paul Quinn and Eastern Illinois from about November through, you know, I'd even say through like mid-January. It's going to be tough, and they're going to have to, that stretch of when they go to Jacksonville, and when they come home to face Wichita State, and then they go to Liberty, that those two, that, you know, that kind of week long stretch there is going to be really, really important for them in terms of setting up, you know, whether or not this is a team that can even begin to think about the bubble or a postseason bid.
Yeah. So the last thing that I think we can kind of touch on real quick is, you know, Ken Pomeroy did release his preseason rankings since the last time we recorded. Thankfully, I want to thank Ken personally. We've had, he's a friend of the pod. So I'm going to personally thank him for releasing those before my previews started going out. Most of the time I feel like they come out and like my previews are like three or four teams in, we have to kind of do a bunch of editing. But we've been able to run with the preseason rankings the whole time. And he has Missouri 96th.
Yeah, 13th in the SEC.
So I completely buy that Missouri will have a not great offense. In fact, so Ken Pom's projections were their adjusted efficiency would be about 98th. And but where I'm going to sort of have an issue is I really don't think Missouri is going to field the worst defensive basketball team that Conzo Martin has had at Missouri. And I think, like, again, like, this is why, as you know, I'm a big, big analytics person. I use them a lot, but it's how you apply them. And one thing to keep in mind is Ken Pomeroy's ratings are not Ken Pomeroy making these assertions himself. He has an algorithm that he's built, and the algorithm puts all these factors into play and spits something out, and that's what he publishes. He doesn't weigh things personally. It's an algorithm. It's the same thing with Bill. Like, people get mad at Bill for Bill's algorithm. So I think that Missouri, if there's one area where I think this team can really be pretty good is on the defensive end. Mainly because I think that they've got guys who have good length. They are fairly big throughout every position. I mean, outside of Wilmore, they don't really have a true center. You know, but they have, like, you know, we've kind of joked about, you know, the dream of Conzo starting like 6-7 guys.
Six, eight,
yeah,
eight.
like 1-5. Like, that's just the starting lineup is all that. And he's close to that. And it's not exactly that, but, you know, it's going to be like, you know, 6-2, 6-3, 6-4, 6-8, 6-9. And that's going to be a lot of their lines. And that's a lot of length. And I think this is going to be a good defensive team.
Yeah. It's, if you look at sort of, Missouri's got the widest range of outcomes so far. If you look at, you know, media polls, bloggers, preseason mags, analytics. Like, Missouri, I think, out of, aside from like Auburn and Missouri have the two widest ranges of where they could finish. You know, some have them as high as 9th, some have them as low as 13th. Usually it comes out around 10th or 11th. So it's, if you're doing that, and you're in KenPom, you're probably going to be in the 70s or 80s. And if the offense is, you know, as bad as, or as sort of, you know, mediocre in the high major sense, the defense is going to have to be pretty good to get them there. So that's, we'll see. The other thing to say is, you know, Ken Pom last year talked about how the impact of not having non-con games skewed the rankings a little bit. We didn't have sort of the data that we normally did, so the algorithm wasn't quite as filled as it normally is. That data is still in there, and it still kind of informs the preseason rankings, and it's going to filter out. So what we have, the 2020 season was weird in a lot of ways, but the impact is still felt in the sense that, like, KenPom's ratings are based his preseason ratings are based in some part off of that old data, and it won't filter out until December. So who knows? Maybe Missouri, like we'd had a normal year, a year last season, maybe they would have wound up like with enough possessions to where they were projected as 10th or 11th in KenPom. But because of how the season played out last year, their data profile was closer to 13th. So just as always, take kind of KenPom with a grain of salt till we get 9 or 10 games into the season and all the old data is filtered out and there's enough possessions to sort of judge a team for what it is in the current season. So that's my wonky spiel.
Don't be a Jesse Newell, kids.
Understand what goes into your analytic rankings. Know what's going in your rankings, kids. It's like Halloween candy. You don't know what's in, like, read the package.
Yeah.
Know what's going in there. Know what's going in your analytic rankings and understand how they get made.
So we're going to wrap this up. Unfortunately, it was a bye week for football, which means you got less Rock'em Nation podcasting. BK and Nate have been doing a bang-up job this season, talking an awful lot about a team with a terrible, terrible defense. But some good recruiting things have happened, and so that's good. And so if you are only tuned in to Rock'em Nation podcast for dive cuts, I would implore you, as a good Missouri fan, to listen to Nate and BK on Before the Box Score. They will be back in a couple days with a new podcast, looking at the big, big Vanderbilt game, Matt. Big time. There are like five power conference teams who have not beaten another power conference team, and two of them are facing off this weekend in Nashville as the Missouri Tigers take on the Vanderbilt Commodores. What do you think? You think Mizzou's going to pull it off?
Yeah, I'll give it to him.
Yeah?
Yeah. I'm going to choose optimism.
For once, we've done it, folks. We've done it. Matt is going to be optimistic about Missouri sports. So we'll be back next week. And it is officially like basketball season. The NBA is on. If you have League Pass, it's got to be rocking. You want to try and find a guest for next week?
Yeah, sure. We should probably talk about what the overall SEC is going to look like. Everyone knows we hate Georgia's roster, but that's for the rest of the league.
Georgia's going to suck. Actually, I think my favorite thing, so I always try to rewrite all my tweets. So today, Ole Miss was published, and I think I basically said, yeah, it's the Ole Miss preview. They're okay.
Yeah.
I don't know what else to say about Ole Miss. Like, you know, like, it is what it is. So we'll talk about some SEC next week, what maybe people can expect from this upcoming season. And, yeah, I think we'll talk to you next week. Thanks for tuning in.